A second force shaping today's political environment is the perpetual scandal culture, which was born as the permanent campaign was growing deep roots in Washington. This is a lasting legacy of the Nixon presidency, as described by Bob Woodward, one of the dogged young journalists who exposed the cover-ups orchestrated by the Nixon White House. Woodward gave an authoritative account of the scandal's culture effect on succeeding presidents from Ford to Clinton in his book Shadow. As Woodward explains, Watergate created a deep distrust of the White House and a more cynical view of politics. Obvious questions arose. Could another president engage in criminal conduct? Did every president secretly plot behind closed doors as Nixon had done? A scandal-based cottage industry was born, including emboldened and congressional inquisitors, investigative reporters, and determined prosecutors and ethics investigators. The habit of deception and hedging practiced by presidents would no longer be acceptable, writes Woodward. However, the endless investigations haven't ended deception in Washington, but rather turned it into just another part of an elaborate warlike game with operatives on both sides of the aisle and both inside and outside of government. Surprisingly, Woodward notes, none of Nixon's successors has managed to fully comprehend the depth of the distrust he left behind. Controversies significant and not so significant were allowed to grow legs in this less trusting environment of inquisition, some turning into notorious and enduring scandals. There was Ford's withholding all details of the deal he believed he had rejected to pardon Nixon, Carter's Burt Lance controversy, Reagan's Iran-Contra scandal, and the defeat of Robert Bork's nomination, and the elder Bush's involvement in Iran-Contra, in the loop or out of the loop, and a series of lesser controversies, from Passportgate and the John Tower nomination to the alleged involvement of Bush's own son, Neil, in the savings and loan scandal. Finally, there was a seemingly endless string of controversies and scandals that ensnared Clinton, from Whitewater to Lewinsky. Each of these presidents, Woodward concludes, had failed to heed the two fundamental lessons of Watergate. First, if there is questionable activity, release the facts, whatever they are, as early and completely as possible. Second, do not allow outside inquiries, whether conducted by prosecutors, congressmen, or reporters, to harden into a permanent state of suspicion and warfare. Inevitably, as these lessons went unheeded and the controversies and scandals took on lives of their own, lasting suspicion and partisan combat resulted, undermining each presidency to some degree. The presidents fueled the controversies by not addressing them openly and directly, fueling a cycle of payback and retribution as congressional leaders of both parties sought to shape public opinion to their own advantage. The result was the creation of a destructive culture of endless scandal. My experience and involvement in politics leads me to conclude that presidents and their inner circles have in fact learned some of the wrong lessons. They've taken a cynical approach to dealing with the scandal culture. Fear of short-term political embarrassment leads them to reflexively manipulate, hide, and distort the truth. Top presidential advisors come to view their job as protecting the president above all else. They create a wall of protection around the Oval Office, making sure the president is sufficiently detached from, and preferably unaware of, the more unsavory side of politics. When controversy arises, they convince the president to embrace defensive tactics. This invariably cedes control of a president's reputation to outside investigations and allows the scandal machine to set the terms of a controversy's duration. What did the president know and when did he know it becomes the central question. But ironically, by seeking to protect themselves, presidents damage their honor and integrity and often put their presidency in jeopardy. The answer is not to get rid of the advisors and lawyers who seek to protect the president from the taint of scandal. The answer, as I'll explain in detail later in this book, is more principled presidential leadership. A third core element of the bitterly partisan Washington environment, one that is part and parcel of the current excessive embrace of the permanent campaign and the deep-seated scandal culture, is the increasingly ruthless, win-at-all-cost attitude that guides many politicians and their advisors in governing to manipulate public approval to their advantage, the philosophy of politics as war. The emergence of the permanent campaign and the scandal culture was bound to lead to growing animosity between the parties. What caused it to spill over into the all-out ideological wars of the 1990s were a series of historic turning points. Even before Watergate, as Lanny Davis, the former special counsel to President Clinton, persuasively argues, the culture wars of the 1960s helped launch the trend. In his book, Scandal, Davis talks of the true believers of the new right, who began to dominate the National Republican Party in 1964. They viewed liberals as cultural enemies who were traitors to American values and who needed to be destroyed. The same period saw the emergence of the ideological purist of the New Left. They embraced radical politics and frightened middle America with the rhetoric of revolution, which they used to express their anger over Vietnam, race, and mainstream culture in general. Both the New Right and New Left took their hardline ideologies far beyond what traditional conservative and liberal standard bearers had advocated. As Davis writes, "The result was that by the end of the 1960s and the 1972 presidential election, both parties were in danger of domination by ideological purists who had personalized their political differences into hatred and vitriol. A dangerous new symmetry had set into the American political culture. For both the New Left and New Right, it was not enough to defeat the political opposition and criticize their policies. It was necessary to destroy the opposition and describe their policies as evil." The cycle of attack and payback, rooted in the high-profile controversies and scandals that followed Watergate, were further defining moments, Davis suggests. The tearing down of Burt Lance, Jimmy Carter's budget director, was in part Republicans' revenge for Watergate. The defeat of Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork through negative attacks and leaks was a big win for Democrats. Republicans came back with a fury during the Clinton years. The cycle showed no signs of stopping. Davis, a Democrat, focuses on the Bork episode, calling it the keystone event that triggered the most vicious subsequent manifestations of the scandal culture and gotcha politics. The issue is not whether there were legitimate reasons for opposing Bork's taking a seat on our nation's highest court. Liberals and experts in constitutional law raised legitimate philosophical concerns and questions about whether Bork had a suitable temperament for the Supreme Court, all of which warranted rational debate. But as Davis notes, the tactics used for defeating Bork crossed a line. Misinformation, distorted accusations, and self-serving leaks for political gain, all part of the unsavory side of today's politics, played a huge role in derailing the Bork nomination. Liberals leading the effort probably justified their tactics as necessary, simply the rules of Washington, the politics as war mentality. But conservatives were left fuming and would not forget the underhanded way liberals brought Bork down, even coining a new verb for the vicious attack strategy, Borking. In looking back, I think another significant turning point was the 1988 presidential campaign. No campaign was more single-mindedly centered on bringing down an opponent than that of George Herbert Walker Bush. With their candidate trailing badly in the polls, his political strategist believed he could not win through an honest debate on the real issues. Instead, they developed a calculated strategy to go negative that had little to do with building their candidate up and everything to do with tearing their opponent, Michael Dukakis, down. The campaign was, by most objective accounts, full of distortions, misrepresentations, and zero-sum politics, accusing Dukakis of everything from embracing furloughs for dangerous criminals to disliking the Pledge of Allegiance, the innuendo being that he was unpatriotic. It was, as recorded in The Quest for the Presidency, by Peter and Tom Matthews Goldman, the systematic dismemberment of Michael Dukakis, based on a scorched-earth strategy. The elder Bush certainly believed in civility and decency. Everything about his record and his personal behavior indicates that, and he is one of the most decent and honorable men I have ever met. But during the 1988 campaign, he acquiesced to certain advisors, including Roger Ailes and the late Lee Atwater, who were intent on winning at all cost, within the bounds of legality. I'm sure that many conservatives viewed it as part of the game and necessary for achieving the right end, but the blood left on the pavement at the end of the one-sided and mean-spirited political street brawl between Bush and Dukakis spilled into the corridors of Congress. The controversies and scandals that engulfed the 41st president's White House were motivated, at least in part, by the desire to exact retribution for what he'd wrought in his campaign. These were the new rules by which politics as war would now be practiced by Democrats and Republicans alike. By 1992, Clinton and his political advisors felt they had learned the lessons of the 1988 campaign: answer every attack, counter misrepresentations, and distortions of one's record by using the same tactics against the opponent. Play by the same rules the opposition plays by, but do it better. Beginning with the 1992 election campaign, the Clinton political machine became famous for its aggressive pushback tactics, its subtle and not-so-subtle intimidation of reporters, its mastery of spin, and its rapid response to charges. An admiring documentary film, The War Room, made Clinton operatives George Stephanopoulos and James Carville media stars as it showed the world how a canny, tough-minded campaign team could control the news cycle and help shape the attitudes of millions of people, for good or ill. Which party shares more blame for the ascendancy of the politics as war philosophy? That is an interesting question that would likely require a lengthy book to dissect. One thing is certain, the philosophy of politics as war has been developing for decades, and elected leaders of both parties bear responsibility for it.